Today is Tuesday, April 10th. We're going to work on urinary system anatomy today. Okay, so bottom of page 105, there's four tracings. Those will be copied exactly as they're written onto your test. What you can do is go ahead and prepare those four, and then that way you've got them already taken care of. When you come to the test, just turn to your essays and knock out your three choices from that list of four. So that is one way to work the essays for the upcoming test. I'll also give you other options. If keeping these straight is not your bag of tricks, then there'll be other options for you on the test come test day. And I'll give you some helpful, you know, guidance as to what to look for. So what we'll do actually today is the very first one. The tracing a pathway of a red blood cell is in fact page 105. Those bullet points start you at the renal artery, take you to the renal vein. That is how red blood cells will travel. And we will do numbers 2, 3, and 4 probably on Thursday, but I want to give you a heads up as to those four down there at the very bottom of your page. Okay, so any other questions about test 4 coming up on Tuesday the 24th? That one at the top is red blood cell pathway. Okay. Yeah. And then I'll help you with the other three. So let me give you a rundown on the commonly missed questions on this test. Looks like the first one was number 11. So I want to check and see if there's anything on that first page you want to talk about. Okay, so we've talked about the phrenic nerve, we've talked about the vagus nerve. The phrenic nerve is only for stimulation of your diaphragm and intercostal muscles. Looking at the list of choices there, the respiratory rate will increase upon stimulation of your phrenic nerve. Vagus nerve actually induces secretions from your stomach. Bile coming from the gallbladder and liver, that's actually a hormone, so that would not be an answer we would choose. And we know heart rate increases, again, due to a hormone like epinephrine, not to the phrenic nerve. So keeping straight that the phrenic nerve is specifically for respiration control, that will eliminate all those other answers there, including the two of these are correct options. How about anything on this page? Okay, let's hit number 15. Okay, so the Valsalva maneuver is a maneuver used by our conscious control of the vocal cords. If you consciously close your vocal cords, you trap air in your lungs, and that increases abdominal pressure. So it is not the epiglottis or any other part there, it's just the vocal cords that shut to help trap air in the lungs. So we use them kind of like a sphincter. Let's see, same page, there number 16. Hypoventilation means a slower breathing rate. The more slowly we breathe, the more carbon dioxide we hang on to. The more carbon dioxide we hang on to, the more acidic our blood becomes. In other words, the lower our pH will drop. So, in fact, we would not increase blood pH, but rather we would decrease blood pH if you hypoventilate. And we would not increase oxygen levels. We would decrease them if we breathe more slowly. So, I know those two of these are correct, makes for a confusing option, but in fact here it's just blood carbon dioxide levels would increase. Anything else on page 3? All right, page 4 has number 24. Okay, so we're looking for a hormone that tells the pancreas to make and release bicarbonate-rich fluids. We've talked about gastrin. Gastrin is made by the stomach to communicate with the stomach, so I would eliminate gastrin as an option. I'd also eliminate gastrin-inhibiting peptide, since its main role is to tell the stomach to stop making its secretions. Amylase is also one that I would eliminate. What does it help us do?
Break down starch, yeah.
So take that one off the list of options, and that leaves you with two. That leaves you with secretin and CCK. Now the trick is figuring out which one is the right one. CCK makes our pancreas release what?
Enzyme-rich,
good. So that leaves us with secretin, okay? And that's the one that tells our pancreas to release bicarb fluids. So it looks like we had a pretty good streak. Not any other commonly missed on this page or the next one. Is there anything there you'd like to talk about? Good so far? Okay. Anything on page six? Oh, the two that are correct is acidosis and exercise. That will shift us to the right, will decrease oxygen saturation. Cold, of course, shifts us to the left and increases oxygen saturation. How about any others so far? Page 4, 5, 6.
What was 24?
24. Secretin.
Oh, is that okay?
Yep, that was secretin. Oh, yeah. All right, so let's hit number 56 on page 7. All right, so if we put more carbon dioxide in the bloodstream, we'll end up making more bicarbonate ions. That's how carbon dioxide is transported. We would end up making the bloodstream more acidic, but yeah, that's not an option there. In fact, respiratory alkalosis would not happen the more CO2 you deposit. It would be the result if you had less CO2 to put in the bloodstream. So other choices there include increasing carbon monoxide, which has nothing to do with carbon dioxide. And we wouldn't necessarily want to decrease oxygen delivery to cells if we had increased CO2. We might, in fact, want to increase oxygen delivery to cells. So looking at the answer choices, again, it's just one. An increase in bicarbonate ions results when you have more CO2 in your bloodstream. Let's see, number 57, same page there. Pancreatic acini cells make enzyme-rich fluids. And so if you don't have enzymes coming into the small intestine, those nutrients are not broken down and they're not absorbed. So what happens to the nutrient content of the feces? It increases, yeah. So unfortunately, that can happen if the pancreas is not doing its job or if there's a blockage there. Okay, so let's see, number 58. We're looking at a problem called hypertension, which is high blood pressure. And in response to this, the vasomotor center will actually do something to help fix the problem. So how do we fix this problem? Yeah, decrease sympathetic. Good. Make those vessels dilate, right? So why is increasing parasympathetic not the best choice?
Make the pressure higher.
There's no...
You have to just wait.
Right, so there's no parasympathetic innervation of the vessels. So too bad it doesn't work that way, but you know, we just have to wait until the sympathetic stimulation decreases. So that makes just one there the right answer. 59, we're looking at coronary arteries getting blood from the aorta. And most veins return blood to the coronary sinus. Okay, so if you're missing review questions consistently, that's just saying, hey, go back and start studying as soon as you can for the final. Because if this stuff is leaking out of your brain now, then you want to go back and start refreshing on it as soon as you can. Let's see, last page there is short answers, so let's talk about those. If you chose letter A, Eating hot, spicy foods, well, I mean, you know, if it's really hot, it's hard to eat in the first place, but hot, spicy foods actually suppress vagus nerve activity. And if you suppress the vagus nerve, a whole bunch of things can happen in the stomach, including decreased gastrin, which leads to decreased hydrochloric acid, and decreased what else? A transit factor, and that means there's now decreased absorption of vitamin
B12,
and the less acid you have in your stomach, the less chance you're converting pepsinogen into pepsin, right? And then now you're looking at decreased breakdown of proteins. So some of you kind of hit the ballpark area on this question and talked about your activities would be decreased, but I was really hoping that you would fulfill like all of those different things, you know, decreased gastrin, decreased hydrochloric acid, kind of give a more full answer for that one. Let's see, for letter B, hyperthermia, first off, is hot. That's a high body temperature. So that, you know, figuring that out certainly is helpful. Some of you went the cold route, which makes it the opposite direction. But if you're hot, then your O2 saturation decreases. And if it's so far down, then we're going to see an increase in the respiration rate. So some of you just got it reversed. You just worked it out for cold, and, you know, I probably gave you half credit for that in that case. I think letter C, y'all were good to go there in most cases. In letter D there, having a gallstone lodged in the hepatopancreatic ampulla would actually block three organs. What are they?
Liver,
gallbladder, and pancreas. And if you block secretions from the liver and gallbladder, what would that secretion be? Bile, yeah. And that means you're not going to emulsify and break down fats. Okay, so that's one issue. And likewise, if you block the pathway from the pancreas, now you're blocking the release of two fluids. Bicarbonate and enzymes. So now you don't neutralize your chyme. Now you don't break down and hydrolyze your food groups. So that can be a big issue. Never mind that it could cause things like pancreatitis. All right, so letter E there, the liver's contribution to blood glucose regulation. Just want to make sure that we know the pancreas doesn't make insulin. The liver doesn't make insulin. The pancreas is that organ that makes insulin. When insulin is present, what does the liver do with glucose? Stores it as
glycogen.
Good. And then if you need that glucose back in your bloodstream, what hormone helps you break it down?
Glucagon,
that's right, glucagon will help us. So you might in fact have talked about insulin or glucagon and that transformation between glucose and glycogen here. And if you chose letter F, I think most of y'all did fine with that one. It's just hepatic portal circulation taking that blood flow through the liver. Any questions on any multiple choice? All right, so those are for you to keep. So today we're going to kind of lay the foundation for the urinary system. We're going to talk about just some anatomy stuff. You probably have seen a lot of this in lab. And then what we'll do on Thursday is we'll kind of crank into how the kidneys function. So Thursday's a more meaty day, you might say, than today will be. Let's start off on page 103. So pretty simple organ system here. We've got two kidneys, two ureter tubes that connect those kidneys to the urinary bladder. One urinary bladder and one urethra that leads the urine to the outside of the body. Let me also mention that we often try to say urinary when we talk about the bladder because we've already discussed another bladder called what?
Gallbladder.
Yeah. So we want to be very specific and, you know, not let somebody wonder which bladder we're referencing. So pretty simple system here. You'll notice that the kidneys and ureters, bladder and urethra, that's really all we've got. We've got those four organs and that's it. And the star of the show are the kidneys, and that's where we're going to focus our attention. So at the very top of your page, let's work through those five major functions of the kidneys. Removal of waste products from the bloodstream is certainly an important job of the kidneys. We're talking about things that are breakdown products. Perhaps, you know, if you break down proteins or break down fats, those waste products get removed into our urine. Likewise, broken down bile components like bilirubin, those are broken down, and that's the reason your urine is actually yellow. So we can learn a lot about our urine just by testing with the urinalysis kit. We can look for normal waste products, and we can also detect things that really shouldn't be discarded into our urine. We also regulate blood volume and composition of the blood using the kidneys. Thinking way back, what are some hormones that help to regulate your blood volume?
Aldosterone.
Antidiuretic. Even epinephrine. Yeah. ANP. Okay, so there's a whole bunch that will influence what we do in terms of either dumping fluids into our urine or keeping those fluids. Number three, helps control the blood pH. The urinary system is actually one of two systems that controls blood pH. The other system we just discussed was respiratory. Yeah, so these two, respiratory and urinary, help to maintain blood pH balance. All right, so we know about blood pressure regulation is a major job here. That's primarily the function of renin, angiotensin, and aldosterone. We will finally come full circle and talk about that mechanism in this chapter. And then finally, we've got EPO there, made under low oxygen levels. What does EPO tell our bone marrow to do?
Make red blood cells.
Good. So the stimulus for EPO is what?
Low oxygen.
Good. EPO stimulus is low oxygen. So when you look at this organ system setup, you'll notice that the right kidney over here on this side is actually sitting a little lower than this left kidney. And so that's not a mistake in the way it's drawn. That actually is reality, that the right kidney sits a tad bit lower. What organ, really large organ, is pushing it out of the way?
Liver.
Yeah, so the liver actually takes up a lot of space and pushes that right kidney down. Each kidney is about the size of a bath bar of soap, about 4 to 5 inches in length, and they're only anchored to the back part of your body wall by fascia and by fat. So, you know, it's amazing that we have such important organs, and they're kind of like just taped to the back part of your body wall and say, just stay there, don't move, right? So, over a lifetime, if you are hit across the back part of your lower ribs, you can jar those kidneys free, and they will start to slide down the back part of your body wall. The danger with that is these ureters, easily seen here, can kink up, just like a drinking straw. And if you bend a drinking straw, what happens to the fluid you're trying to pass through? They get stuck. So what happens to urine that's trying to escape the kidneys? Stuck in there and backed up, right. So that can be a very dangerous situation. We would not be able to get rid of that urine if we happen to have those kidney ureters kink up. Let's see, we've got on top of each one of our kidneys a gland called what?
Adrenal
gland, good. Okay, so that should take us through the middle of the page there. The medial indentation here where the vessels come and go?
Hillus.
Good. All right, so let's turn our attention to kidney anatomy down there near the bottom of your page. We're going to cut into a kidney and look at the three main regions here. From outermost to innermost, the most superficial region we call a renal cortex. Middle layer is called the medulla or medulla, and the most innermost layer or region is what we call a pelvis portion of the kidney. Okay, so in this picture, the outermost portion is actually called the renal capsule, and it's this brown portion on the very outside. I kind of think of it like an apple. If you were to take a peeler and peel off the skin of an apple, you would just be taking away that capsule. The next portion is called the cortex, Okay, and this cortex is a certain type of tissue that's around the outside of the kidneys, and the cortex also makes up these renal columns. Okay, so what the renal cortex does not include is what?
The
renal pyramids, yeah. So cortex is just this outermost portion in the columns. Cortex does not include these triangular shaped renal pyramids. Okay. Those renal pyramids actually belong to another region called what?
Medulla.
Renal medulla or medulla. Good. So as we come around, there's the renal medulla. Okay, so we've got these renal pyramids in that area. And then finally, the last region is a basin-like area called the renal pelvis. And what gathers here, collects here?
Urine.
Good. And then, of course, from that point, we would be traveling down the ureter and on our way for storage in the urinary bladder. On your worksheet, you've got calyces. Let's talk about those. When urine is formed, it drips from the tips of these renal pyramids. These tips here are called renal what?
Papilla.
Good. So when urine drips from those tips, it enters a grooved area called a what?
Minor calyx.
Minor calyx. Good. And where two of those minors come together, you then have a
major
calyx. If you continue to travel, you'll end up in this basin-like area called your
pelvis.
Good. So, in fact, you actually have part of a flow pathway already. It's at the very bottom of your page. When urine flows, it drips from the tips of the renal papilla, heads to a minor calyx, to a major calyx, to the renal pelvis, and then the ureter, urinary bladder, and urethra. So if you think about baseball, play for the minor leagues, go to the major leagues, that's what urine does. It goes from the minor calyces to the major calyces. So far, so good. Any questions here? So top of page 104, you probably saw this model in lab. It's a life-size kidney model, about a 4 or 5 inch tall kidney model. And you may have noticed on those kidney models, these little squiggly white lines. What do they represent?
Loops.
Nephron loops, yeah, good. So in each kidney, you have around 1 million nephrons. These are the functional units of your kidney, okay? So these little squiggly white lines represent the nephrons and their loops. Each kidney has about 1 million of these functional nephrons. In fact, if you happen to lose a kidney or donate a kidney, your remaining kidney can actually add nephrons to be able to accommodate for filtration of blood. So that's how people can live with one functional kidney. Over a lifetime, though, our kidneys become less efficient. You know, with each decade of life, we tend to lose some of those nephrons. So, you know, as your body ages, your kidneys become less able to get rid of the waste products. So it's just the nature of the way our bodies age. Okay, so what I'd like to do is talk to you about the two main portions of the nephron. I got you a teeny tiny picture there on that page, or you can use the picture that's in your course pack on 111. Okay, so we'll see what we can do with this thing. All right, so I'm going to start you with the renal corpuscle. That's one of two components here. And the renal corpuscle includes a set of capillaries and a capsule that surrounds it. So I'm just going to circle this area right there, and we'll just label that as our renal corpuscle. Inside the renal corpuscle are a set of little knotted up capillaries. These capillaries are called the glomerulus, or you can call them glomerular capillaries. So they look like little loops there inside. Those are our glomerular capillaries. And they're surrounded by a capsule called what?
Bowman's
capsule. Good. So we've taken care of one major component of a nephron. This component is called a renal corpuscle. It is composed of two parts, a set of capillaries called the glomerulus or the glomerular capillaries, and then there's a capsule that surrounds it called the Bowman's capsule or a glomerular capsule. I should tell you that they're trying to get away from naming stuff after people because it's not very descriptive. So they're trying to use terms like glomerular capsule instead of Bowman's capsule. Nonetheless, what I do on test time is I'll put, you know, one word in parentheses so you don't have to worry about, well, gosh, what if I don't recognize the word? I'll try to put them like that on the test so you can see which one I'm talking about. So let's now move on to the renal tubule, which is the remaining portion of this nephron. Okay, so the first set of curvy tubes close by your renal corpuscle, these are called the PCT. What does that P stand for?
Proximal.
Meaning what?
Closest to.
Closest to. So what are we closest to?
The glomerulus.
Glomerulus, yes. Yeah, so we're closest to that renal corpuscle, that glomerulus. And this set of twisty tubes is the first portion of our renal tubule. So if we just take our finger and follow the flow path here, we now travel down a hairpin curve. It is called a nephron loop, or you can call it the loop of Henle. There is a descending limb heading down the left side. I'll just put a D there for that. And then on the other side, there's an ascending limb that's coming back up. So as we're traveling along, we're now going to come upon another twisty tube. This tube is farther from your glomerulus, so we should call it what?
Distal.
Good. So we'll put a DCT about there. So if you imagine houses sitting on a street, all with their sewage pipes hooking up to a main pipe on the street, that main sewage pipe carries away all the waste products from all those houses. That's where we're at now. We're at something called a collecting duct or a collecting tube, and that is this piece over here. We sometimes call it CD or CT for short, you know, representing collecting duct or collecting tube. Every one of these little things that looks like a stump is actually a DCT that hooks in. So that means that other nephrons actually use the same collecting duct to dump in their waste products into this collecting tube. Okay, so what are the parts of a renal tubule?
DCT.
Good. We'll talk about it when we do countercurrent multiplication, but I would know which one's down and which one's up.
Will that always be descending is closest to the renal cortex?
Yeah.
Or corpuscle?
Yeah, it's, and the way it's laid out here, it's always going to be closest, you know. So to kind of put this in perspective, I know we've talked about renal pyramids. If you were to take this collecting duct and extend it down a little bit, then what this is actually part of is one of those renal pyramids. You may have noticed in lab, especially those bigger models, the renal pyramids have a striped appearance to them. Looks like a bunch of lines running down this way. They're all pointing at the tip of the renal papilla. So, of course, urine drips off the bottom down here into one of those minor calyces. So it kind of gives you like, okay, this is where this is sitting within the entire kidney. Okay, so they just didn't draw any further. They probably could have extended on and shown us how this all, you know, links together. Something else I want to tell you is this. This is a flat picture. This is not the way it sits in our kidneys. The real way that this sits in our kidneys is like this. So if you were to take your piece of paper and coil it up, that's how the nephron actually sits within the kidney space. And I want to make that point because if you realize that it sits kind of wrapped up like this around itself, then you'll realize, okay, which portion here is actually butting up against my glomerulus? You can kind of turn it around here and see, well, the DCT is actually kind of wrapping around and giving a hug right up against that glomerulus. That's going to be an important point when we move to the next topic on your page. I've got to take you back again, which is something called the JGA. The what? That's it. You got it. Juxtaglomerular apparatus. That's it. Okay, so if you come back with me to page 104, about halfway down the page, look for a term called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So let's talk about this picture. Do you recognize the glomerular capillaries? Okay, so they are all knotted up right here, okay? Do you see the Bowman's capsule? Okay, so it surrounds. How about the PCT? Left side or right side?
Left
side.
Left side. So there's the PCT right there. How about the DCT? On the right side. So I know this is confusing because you're like, well, wait a minute, proximal means closest to the glomerulus. And the DCT, D means farthest from the glomerulus. And it really is, if you take your finger and trace yourself all the way through, but then we have to appreciate that this whole nephron gives itself a hug. And in fact, what's far ends up being smacked right up against that glomerular capillary network, okay? And so because it's set up this way, you've got the DCT sitting right here. Okay, it's kind of like wrapping around, giving a hug. It is snug right up against an arteriole coming in called the afferent arteriole, and it's snug against an efferent arteriole exiting. So something weird here is going on. Normally, when we did blood flow, we said that arterioles feed capillaries. That drains into what? Venules, yeah. Here you have an arteriole feeding a capillary bed, being drained by an arteriole. Yeah, so this in itself is odd, the fact that we have arterioles coming in and arterioles leaving. So tell me about blood pressure. Would you expect to have high blood pressure in a venule?
No.
How about in an arteriole?
Yes.
So why put an arteriole on the exit route from these capillaries?
Push it,
yeah. Push that filtrate out. Because if you have low pressure coming through these vessels and low pressure sitting here in these capillaries, are you going to get rid of waste products?
Oh.
Nope. So put a high pressure feed coming in, put a high pressure feed going out, and that's going to force that stuff out of the bloodstream, waste products, blood plasma, electrolytes, that we then capture here by this Bowman's capsule. So kind of going back then, our whole point of looking at this picture was to discuss the juxtaglomerular apparatus. These little cells sitting right here, they're kind of a triangular shaped region between your DCT, afferent arteriole, and efferent arteriole. They're called our JGA cells, okay? And it is their job to detect blood pressure problems. What happens to your ability to get rid of waste products if you have low blood pressure? You can't do it. So you need to force that blood plasma out of the vessel, and if you don't have too much force, you keep the waste products. That's not what we want to do. So if you have low blood pressure, this JGA sitting right there, it's going to turn on a chemical called renin. Ah, we've been here before, right? Okay, so low blood pressure is detected by the cells in the JGA. Those JGA cells will release renin. And renin, of course, tells the liver to make angiotensin. We convert angiotensin 1 to 2. Good, aldosterone and ADH. Good, so this whole thing, finally we've come full circle. Now we can talk about every component of this renin-angiotensin mechanism. So I've got it kind of shortened on your worksheet. If you need the whole laid out thing here, I'll give y'all a moment to jot it down, or if you'd like a picture.
Is that on PowerPoint?
It is in the PowerPoint, yeah. Okay, so what is the stimulus to turn on this renin-angiotensin mechanism? Good. And how do we solve that problem? Turn on renin. Okay, and who releases renin? Sure. JGA. And they're where? Kidney. Yes, the JGA is in the kidney. And so renin travels from the kidneys to the liver, tells the liver make and release angiotensin. Good. And so angiotensin 1 is converted to angiotensin 2 using
ACE.
Good. What does it mean that angiotensin 2 is a vasoconstrictor? Constricts and squeezes, right. And how does that help our problem?
It increases blood pressure.
Increases blood pressure, right. So we're almost fixing the problem, but it's kind of like a 1-2 punch solution. So the second round of the solution is to release these hormones. What specifically does aldosterone make us retain?
Salt.
And ADH makes us retain
water.
Good. So squeezing the vessels only works so much. You got to have some fluid in there to help maintain cardiac output and heart rate. Okay, so if you want to shut this mechanism down, let's say you've got a patient who has high blood pressure, and it's determined that this high blood pressure is due to excess aldosterone. You can give them a medication called an ACE inhibitor. The ACE inhibitor blocks the release of ACE. And so what does that actually shut down in this whole mechanism?
No conversion from angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2.
Good. No conversion. And we stop it basically at angiotensin 1. We don't make angiotensin 2. We won't release as much aldosterone or ADH. So pretty much from that angiotensin 2 point down, we're going to shut off this mechanism. Someone who takes an ACE inhibitor, would they expect to have higher than normal blood pressure, or should it be lower? Should be lower, right, because we're stopping those things that increase blood pressure. Let me also show you what else angiotensin 2 can do. Going back to this picture, angiotensin 2 can also squeeze the exit route, that efferent arteriole. Why do you think it squeezes that vessel and not the one leading blood into the glomerulus? Blood's leaving, and if you don't let the blood get out, where does it back up into? Glomerulus, right? And if you back it up into the glomerulus and you've got high pressure coming in, you're going to filter, right? Okay, so if you've got, say, angiotensin 2 at that efferent arteriole, it squeezes that vessel, it makes it harder for blood to exit, and the blood backs up and is forced to be filtered here by these capillaries. So that is, in fact, what we want if you're having low blood pressure. Let that blood get filtered. All right, so any questions so far about juxtaglomerular apparatus?
And you said that angiotensin 2 squeezes the efferent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the efferent one.
What did you say the cells in the middle?
They're just, they detect blood pressure.
Oh, okay.
So if you've got low blood pressure, and they're in the JGA, these cells here, all they're doing is looking for low blood pressure.
So then they can tell the efferent to
In a way, yeah, but they send a message to the liver, and the liver comes back with angiotensin, which eventually squeezes that. Yeah. It'd be nice if they could just say, hey, constrict. All right. Let's talk about two types of nephrons. On the very bottom of your page, you've got cortical nephrons and juxtamedullary. The words here are awful.
Yeah.
Okay, so in this picture, you're looking at a snapshot of a kidney. Out here in the outer region, you've got the renal cortex. Down below, this is the renal medulla, and there's the renal pyramid's tip, that papilla. You'll notice this short nephron loop on that cortical nephron versus the really long nephron loop on this juxtamedullary nephron. That's an important difference between these two types of nephrons. Also, those cortical nephrons mostly sit out here in the cortex region, while the juxtamedullaries mostly sit down here in the medullary or medullary region, so they're deeper into the kidney. Now, there's an important thing to appreciate about the length of those nephrons. If you're sending filtered blood through these nephron loops, notice the length here. That one's really short in the cortex. This juxtamedullary nephron has a really long nephron loop. The more time your filtered blood spends traveling through those nephron loops, the more opportunity you have to reabsorb fluids back into your bloodstream. So which one of these do you think is going to produce really concentrate dark yellow urine?
The
juxtamedullaries. Why is that?
Because it's longer.
It's longer. And your body does what to the fluids?
Absorb it
back, right. If you're sending your blood mostly through a cortical nephron, like these up here, they're short nephron loops, and you're able to produce more dilute, light-colored urine. So basically, this is a way for us to, you know, concentrate urine, and the whole goal here is to make sure that your blood is the right saltiness or right salinity. So what we dump into the urine is just a result of what we want to get rid of. All right, so that should take us down there to the bottom of page 104. How about questions so far?
So with those nephrons,
I think your body has, in terms of blood pressure, regulates which one we route to, or how much gets sent to one versus another. Mm-hmm. On page 105, I've got a blood supply to the nephron for you. It is in order as blood would flow through the kidney. That is the answer to the first essay at the very bottom of your page in the box. And I should also tell you this, kidneys are strange. You know, when our bodies form before we were born, you know, you don't think about having organs form and get absorbed by the body and then form again and then get reabsorbed by the body. But that's what happens to the kidneys. They get formed and reabsorbed about 4 times on average. Imagine if your brain did that. Here's a brain. Oh, no, we're not taking that brain. Here's another brain. I mean, that's just not the way any other organ works. So the reason for a lot of discrepancy with blood flow must be due to the fact that our kidneys are formed and reabsorbed numerous times. If you pick up any A&P textbook in the library or search a blood flow pathway on the internet, I guarantee you you're going to get different answers from all the books and all the internet pathways you find. So we're going to use the one that our textbook goes with. At least we'll have consistency there. And you'll notice that there are 5 arteries flowing into the kidney, but only 4 veins on the exit pathway. So some books include segmental on the exit path out. We're just going to skip the segmental on our exit pathway. Instead of reading those to you, let's look at a picture and work our way in. We're going to start with the renal artery that takes blood into the kidney. And that renal artery typically gives rise to around 5 segmental arteries. Those segmental arteries give rise to another set called what?
Interlobars.
Good. And you'll notice those interlobars wedge themselves between your renal pyramids. Sitting at the base of your renal pyramids is another set of arteries. These are called what?
Arcuate.
And they give rise to a set of arteries that are on the cortex called?
Cortical radiate.
Now, you can call the cortical radiates interlobular arteries, but I caution you doing that because you've already had the interlobar arteries coming through here. So it is very easy to get them mixed up and confused. If you do prefer to use the word interlobular, just keep in mind, as we trek into the kidney, the words get longer. Interlobar, then eventually interlobular artery. Let me show you a trick on this picture here. I think you guys have a model in lab that looks like this. General rule of thumb is this arcuate artery sitting right here tends to run horizontal on those models. It's sitting at the base of a renal pyramid. So the renal pyramid's bottom is here, and the point is down this way. And that makes sense because here comes the collecting duct, and it points at the tip of the renal pyramid. So anytime you see a horizontal sitting artery with one of these nephrons, you're probably looking at an arcuate artery. Sitting vertical coming off of it is what artery?
Cortical radiate.
Cortical radiate, yep. So they call it interlobular here, but it does sit vertical. Arcuate sits horizontal. So that just a helpful trick. I know you got enough to keep straight for the lab test, but that's just a helpful hint. Let's see, from that cortical radiate artery, we're going to branch off and give rise to an afferent arteriole. It's going to lead us into the glomerular capillaries. And since we're tracing blood flow, blood cells and such will not be filtered here. So after the glomerular capillaries, where do we go next?
Efferent
arteriole. So we're going to exit. Okay. And like I mentioned, that's an odd pathway. Normally arterioles feed capillaries into venules, but here we have arterioles feeding capillaries back into arterioles, back into capillaries. Okay, and then we finally reach the venule, but the set of capillaries we head to next wrap around this nephron loop, and they're called?
Peritubular capillaries.
Good, peritubular capillaries, good. All right, eventually we reach a venule right about there, and it links us up with that cortical radiate vein. It too is going to sit vertical, okay, and it links us up with a horizontal arcuate vein, which is sitting right through there. All right, we're on the way back out, so let's go back a picture. From arcuate vein sitting at the base of your pyramids,
interlobar,
and
into the
Nobody.
Yeah. You're right, there's no segmental vein, so we head right straight back to that renal vein. Okay, so from the top, we head from renal artery. Okay, and then here we go. On this picture, we've got
afferent arterioles, glomerulus, efferent arterioles,
peritubular capillaries,
venules, and then the cortical radiate.
Cortical radiate vein.
And arcuate
vein.
Antelope vein. And the renal vein.
Good, good.
So I'm
going
to tell them.
Yes.
Well, when we do this vein for the essay question, just the venules, you don't have to put renal vein venules?
Venule works.
Okay.
Yeah. And by the way, if you want to put A for artery and V for vein, that helps kind of shorten it too, so.
Okay.
All right, so this is blood flow, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets take this pathway. They're not to be filtered. I think we all realize that if you have blood in your urine and you're not a female menstruating, that bloody urine means, hey, something's going wrong, like an infection. Pus, which is white blood cells in the urine, indicates something else like an infection. And platelets should not be exiting in the urine either. So they are not meant to be filtered. That's their pathway. This is going to join right through the kidney, and they come right back out. All right, so how about questions on that flow pathway? Sounds like a lot of you actually are good with this, and that's one you got under your belt.
So they're just there to carry oxygen?
Basically, yeah. Alright, so what I'd like to do is just kind of introduce you to the jobs that the kidney does. Just kind of go a little bit into this, and then we'll come back to this page and repeat it. On the top of page 106, you'll notice there are three main activities of the nephron: filtration, tubular reabsorption, and tubular secretion. So I'd like to talk to you about filtration, and we'll come back and do this again. But I wanted to take a look at this glomerulus because this is the site of filtration in your nephron. And if you think about having a million of these nephrons and a million of these glomeruli, then you're looking at lots of filtration that can occur over, you know, a time period. So when the blood comes into our glomerulus from an afferent arteriole, it has to come in under high pressure. When it leaves under an efferent arteriole, it also leaves under fairly high pressure. The goal of having high pressure both coming in and going out from the glomerular capillaries is to maintain filtration. So what was the pressure that forced fluids out of our capillaries? Let's see, was it hydrostatic or osmotic?
Hydrostatic.
Yeah. So we've got to maintain high enough push of the fluids in order to force those fluids out of our glomerular capillaries. You may notice these strange looking cells here. They're called podocytes. These little, they're called foot parts that kind of stretch out and wrap around your kidney's capillaries. Those podocytes are actually like porous. So they are just big enough to let fluids and electrolytes to escape from your bloodstream, but they're small enough to not let out blood cells. But they're there to help us increase the porousness of these capillaries. So each one of these cells here, they're called podocytes that wrap around those glomerular capillaries. Let me give you an analogy. If you cook, say, spaghetti or pasta at home, you may have a colander that you pour your pasta in when you're done. And it works because the holes on your colander are the right size, right? Because it lets the water travel through. That's what we want to do, let the water travel through, but not your pasta. I mean, how ridiculous, right? If you had holes on your colander this big, there goes your pasta down the sink. We want to keep the big stuff in. So when we're letting blood travel through your glomerular capillaries, that is key. Big stuff does not get filtered. What I mean, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets don't get filtered, neither do plasma proteins like albumin, thyroglobulin, antibodies. You don't filter that stuff, it's too big. The tiny stuff like electrolytes, glucose, amino acids, waste products get filtered. Water gets filtered. So if you're small enough to fit through the podocyte's membrane slits, then you get pushed out and captured by that Bowman's capsule. Otherwise, you just keep traveling in the bloodstream because you're too big to fit through that membrane pore. So if you do happen to have inflammation here in the glomerular capillaries, like say from a kidney infection, and your blood cells escape, you can't get them back. There's no way to reabsorb red blood cells. So if they get out of your glomerular capillaries, they're gone. You know, that's the end of them. So that's just something we want to kind of appreciate, is what you are going to filter out versus what you should not be filtering out. Likewise, whatever you push out of these glomerular capillaries is captured by what? Bowman's capsule. Good. Bowman's capsule is going to capture that stuff. And the stuff that we just pushed out of the glomerular capillaries used to be blood plasma. But if I called it blood plasma, you would assume it's in a bloodstream, right? So we're going to change the name of that stuff we just pushed out, and we're going to call it filtrate. So what is pushed out and captured by your capsule, we're going to call this stuff filtrate. Okay, so my parting thought for you today is how we do it, and that's going to be pressure-driven. What pressure do you think is responsible for forcing fluids out of your glomerulus? Hydrostatic, right. So you'll notice here hydrostatic pressure. We're going to call it GHP for glomerular hydrostatic pressure. It's pretty high. It's about 55 millimeters mercury. I don't know if you remember the number back from other capillaries, but normal capillaries are like 35. So this is really hard push against these vessels, you know, pushing that fluid out. Osmotic pressure here is a little higher. Whoops. So that's push. And pull. That's the story we did before, right? There's the push of hydrostatic pressure and there's the pull of osmotic pressure. But this time there's actually a third pressure that plays a role, and that one is called capsular hydrostatic pressure. So when you push fluids out into that glomerular capsule, these fluids hanging out here actually create pressure that forces fluids, or at least it tries to, push them back into where they just came from. So it's actually working against what we're trying to accomplish. So that capsular, we'll just call it CHP, hydrostatic pressure, they say is about 15. And it's actually pushing fluids back into those glomerular capillaries. You don't have to know these numbers. The number that you will want to know is this one, net filtration pressure. Is 10. So I know you've heard that number before, right? Okay. So normally at the arterial end of a capillary, NFP is 10. And here, also in our kidneys, we're looking at a net filtration pressure of about 10. So, you know, this is kind of where we're jumping off. If you have anything that influences the fluid, the salts and proteins in your bloodstream, it doesn't take much to upset this balance. So that's where we're looking at, you know, renin and angiotensin trying to maintain a net filtration pressure. So why don't we repeat this stuff on Thursday? I'll pick you back up on this page, and then we'll aim to get almost all the way through this chapter if we can on Thursday. Thank you.
Yeah.